Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Almost everything we consume online is free. Email, search, news, entertainment. But those apps on our phones aren't really free. So if we're not paying, who is? Our first guest today, author John Marshall, talks about why free is bad, how the free web hurt privacy, truth, and democracy, and what you can do about it. Later in the program, we are rejoined once again by historian and media studies scholar Nolan Higdon. We'll discuss a recent article, Ripe for Fascism, a post-coup de Trump autopsy of American democracy in the wake of the January 6th events at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
Crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief. Confine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out the reach. All potential fame at the table.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, in this segment, we're going to talk about a new publication titled Free is Bad, How the Free Web Hurt Privacy, Truth, and Democracy, and What You Can Do About It. Here to discuss this incredibly timely subject is John Marshall. He's the author of Free is Bad. He's a serial digital marketing entrepreneur and a patent holder in analytics tracking. His company's built advertising and analytics tools and delivered the first distance learning training courses in digital marketing. After launching and selling three successful startups, John turned his focus to the insights he'd gleaned about the nature of web advertising and consumer behavior. He's since become a firm believer that our current relationship with the web as a free service has led to untenable compromises in service, information, and truth. However, he also believes the web can be a powerful tool that delivers quality services and information while still respecting our privacy, but only if we're willing to be the customer. John Marshall, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Mickey, thanks so much. It's really an honor to be with you.
I'm incredibly interested in our conversation today. After reading your book, and of course you have two versions, you have a nearly 300-page version of Free is Bad, and of course you have the so-called TLDR version for web folks. Too long, didn't read. It's 80 or so odd pages, and we'll talk later about how folks can get a copy of that. But John Marshall, I want to get into what it means to be the customer and get into a lot of the details of ad tech and so many things that you write about, but this is the culmination of decades of education, experience, insights. Tell our listeners a little bit about your background and then how it situated you to write this book and make this argument about the web.
Obviously, I'm originally from Britain, just a minor detail there. I've lived in the States for more than half my life. It's been 27 years at this point. So for the record, I'm a citizen here and I have been for quite a long time. I came to California originally with a tech business that I had. So I've actually been in the tech business. You're going to laugh when you hear this, but I've actually been in the tech business for 40 years and I'm 54. I did actually start when I was 14. Along the way, you know, various different things, but along the way, I was very early in internet stuff. I mean, I think compared to a lot of business people, I was early into internet. I worked at Netscape. That was one of my jobs. And then I had these internet startup companies which ended up being in the area of ad tech. So if you were to sum up my career, the last 20 years of entrepreneurship, you would say I was an ad tech guy. At the beginning, I really felt really pretty good about that. I was helping small businesses to promote themselves and advertise and acquire customers. And that just seemed to be nothing but a good thing. I loved it. And then over the last few years, you look at what's going on and your conscience is pricked. Like, this is really turning out to be not so good. There's been a lot of focus on the problems that we have. I decided to take a slightly different approach in writing the book. And what I wanted to avoid was writing yet another publication that has a load of hand-wringing and a load of criticism and no practical advice. I don't like leaving problems unsolved. If I see a problem, I like to think through, here's a solution, and I wanted that. So I decided to write the book explaining problems, more importantly, how a consumer can straightforwardly solve those problems for themselves without needing to get Congress to come in and fix things for them or some other stuff, right? So that, in the end, that's the genesis of the book. Identifying problems and explaining why those problems may be important to somebody, or indeed maybe not. Here are some solutions that can work for any individual consumer.
John Marshall, before we get more into the details, and that is something I have to commend about your book. We read a lot of these books in media studies, communications, social sciences, hand-wringing. Many of us are experts at hand-wringing. But like Nolan Higdon and I had done with United States of Distraction, we went into that with a whole deal of saying, like, you can't just write this whole train wreck of a How We Got Here book and then leave a paragraph at the end for what we do. You know, you've got to have a real substantive game plan here. Gives people something concrete to work with. And I think that that's one of the strongest suits of your book, is that you're very clear and very good about identifying the challenges, some of the problems, and then telling people what they can actually do in their lives to try to regulate some of this chaos. We'll get into that more specifically. But before we jump in further, I do want you to identify and define the term ad tech. If you could just give us a quick definition.
As technology has grown, there are these aspects to it that seemed unimportant in the history, but suddenly they become big business, or in some way, everybody needs to have some knowledge of them and understanding of them. So we invent these terms. I can just say the word ad tech, and all of my friends on LinkedIn, all of my colleagues on LinkedIn, they know exactly what I'm talking about. But what exactly is it? It is the mechanism by which, when you use a product on the web, you use a service on the web, and you see advertising within that, that advertising is presented to you via an intermediary that's called an ad tech company. If you go to a website and the website is the Chicago Tribune, and you look at an article in the Chicago Tribune, there will be advertisements on that page, and those advertisements are being served up by an ad tech company, not by the Tribune. And a little refinement is that there are rare cases, although they're big, where the serving up of the stuff that you want and the advertisements is done by the same company. And the best known examples of that would be Facebook and Google. So strictly speaking, Facebook and Google are also ad tech companies, although you might put them as just tech companies. That's what ad tech is.
Thanks for the clarification, John Marshall. That's relevant moving forward. So let's get behind the title, Free is Bad. I know some of the folks in the audience might be scratching their heads and saying, hey, wait, what's this about? Is there a pro-capitalist slant going on? You have a couple of great epigraphs here in the book. You have a couple quotes from Stuart Brand, including a conversation between Brand and Steve Wozniak from Apple going back to the 1980s. That quote was, on the one hand, information wants to be expensive because it's so valuable. The right information in the right place just changes your life. On the other hand, information wants to be free because the cost of getting it out is getting lower and lower all the time. Can you riff on that for us, John Marshall, and talk a little bit more what you mean about that title?
I had this really interesting moment when I was thinking about the book. And what I realized is that the quote that you cite there, only half of it is widely known. It's really interesting. You can talk to business people and people that have been in the internet space for a long time. And so far, there have been no exceptions to this rule. I can say to them, have you heard the expression, information wants to be free? And they say, yes. And I say, do you know the other half of it? And they say, what other half? There has not been an exception to that. I'm not joking. So what I realize is that we've all grown up with this idea that free is good. That's just deeply embedded in our brains, especially if you are younger, that free is good. Yet at the same time, You can't run a business like that. You have to have a customer. You have to have somebody who pays. Otherwise, the business can't work. So we have basically created an environment where we refuse to pay because we think that free is good. And we don't accept the negative consequences of that. We're kind of behaving like children. And so I decided to title the book Free is Bad, because I just wanted to hit people over the head with the idea that actually free is not always good. There are situations where free is good. And I do, you know, I go into that in, you know, there's pro bono work. I mean, I'm not going to criticize Wikipedia. There's, you know, there's a bunch of instances where free is good. I think it does also stem from my experiences in business. Another motivation for me in writing the book was just thinking about my own experience running a business and thinking about always, always, I mean, no exception, 2 o'clock in the morning, you wake up in a cold sweat, and I'm thinking about customers. Always, always in my business, I was thinking about the needs of customers, and are my customers happy? Do my customers like what I'm doing? Everything really in the end about the business was worrying about customers. So if we go through a world in which we believe free is good, getting free stuff is an unalloyed good, unquestionably, it's a good thing. We go through that world, and at the same time, those businesses are doing what businesses need to do, which is to have happy customers. And we refuse to be the customer because we're unwilling to pay, well, that's probably going to lead to us not being so happy, because the business isn't really interested in making us happy. They're interested in making their customers happy. That's what they got to do. Honestly, the title and a whole bunch of thinking came from, yes, I have experience in ad tech, but it's more than that. It's also, as a businessman, as an entrepreneur, if you want to sum it up crudely, as a capitalist. Obviously, Anglo-Saxon democracies are facing problems. And I just started to wonder if maybe I was playing a hand in creating those problems. And so I came to the realization that in many cases, we would be better off if we were the customer, in which case the businesses could treat us more honestly.
I'd like to remind our listeners that we are speaking with John Marshall, entrepreneur from the ad tech industry, has a book called Free is Bad: How the Free Web Hurt Privacy, Truth, and Democracy. After this brief musical break, we're going to return to our conversation with John Marshall, and we're going to talk about how all of this has impacted social media, news media, and journalism, and of course, democracy itself. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Free is Bad: How the Free Web Hurt Privacy, Truth, and Democracy is a new book by our guest today, John Marshall. He's a serial digital marketing entrepreneur and patent holder in analytics tracking. He has spent 40 years in the technology sector as an entrepreneur. He is also an author of a new book. Again, that book is titled Free is Bad: How the Free Web Hurt Privacy, Truth, and Democracy. And before the break, John Marshall, you were talking to us about what that phrase meant, the history of the full quotation of that concept and idea. And when you get into the book, and I want to make sure that our listeners know there's two versions of this. There's a long version, nearly 300 pages, and then there's an abbreviated version that's about 80-some pages. That's very well researched, and it lays out pretty clearly your argument. In the book, you talk about your history, your background, and then you begin to really lay out for the reader how these concepts apply to media. So I wanted to jump ahead to a part of the book on how this idea, free is bad, how does that work in social media? Here we are, right after the January 6th events at the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., what some in the news media and across social media platforms are referring to an insurrection or a coup or these types of things. But social media played a real role in that. And of course, it's played a major role in the sensationalism and the fever-pitched hyper-partisanship of the Donald Trump presidency. John Marshall, could you get into a little bit of that for us? Because you really lay out the concept about free is bad, use of social media, particularly the concept of how we're not the consumers, we're the product.
In many ways, that's the nub of the problem. For the record, I use social media. I do want to be completely transparent with our listeners here. I use social media, and I honestly don't see social media as entirely a force of evil. I know people who do, and I respect that. That's not my perspective. I use it, and I'm very strict about this. I use it as a form of entertainment and keeping in touch with people. When I want to know facts, I go to other places and I get facts in a very deliberate way from people that are in the business of publishing facts. So I think you are definitely creating problems for yourself, let alone problems for society, if you go to social media for facts, whether it is to consume facts or even to broadcast facts. The right place for that is news media, which isn't problem-free either. I've got a chapter on social media, and I've got three chapters on the news media. It's not like just saying, I'll go to the news and you, all your problems are solved. It's not that simple. But I treat social media sort of the way I treat a horror movie. I want to have my emotions tweaked. I like having my emotions tweaked. It's entertainment. It's fun. It's fine. But I don't treat it as real life. I put it down and leave it at that. For people that don't do that, I'm here to tell you that that's probably not a good idea. If you treat social media as truth, I can't stop you from doing that. And I don't think legislation can stop you from doing that. I don't think any kind of legislation could stop people from shouting about things on social media and engaging in debate and dialogue or any of that stuff. I'm not even sure that they should. But it isn't the place that we go to for facts. I don't read Stephen King in order to get facts. It's entertainment and it works great. When I want facts, I go and read something else. So honestly, Mickey, that's my opinion about social media. Maybe I should add one final thing. I should add one final thought on this, because we said earlier, hey, free is bad. The title really is meant to cause people to slow down and think. I will tell you, and the book goes into a little bit of history here, there are paid for social media platforms. They exist. I've tried them. I don't see that being viable. I just don't see that really working. I think that free social media funded through advertising, I don't know that there's an alternative. And I don't know either that that's entirely bad, because I don't see how regulation there could really work. I'm just begging everybody here for the third time, I'm begging you, don't treat it as fact.
John Marshall, social media isn't supposed to be news or journalism, but what's happened because of these ad tech models, because of the advertising revenue model that Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky outlined in Manufacturing Consent over 30 years ago, the ownership, advertising, sourcing model of journalism. And you actually go through a great brief history of this in your book, where you talk about the printing press and then the advent of radio and then television and then cable and then the internet and then smartphones and social media. And that's actually kind of an exponential trajectory there. And it gets pretty steep and fast as we go, the sociological speed up there. But you're also suggesting that there is such a thing as real journalism, and we shouldn't be surprised if we have to pay for it, given what's involved in it. But is there another angle in your mind? Is there a way that this could be publicly funded as a free press service? Is there a way around that model that you're decrying as problematic and free is bad?
I'm sorry to disappoint you, Mickey, but so far I am unsure. One of the difficulties I think we have is the pre-existing mindset that we bring to the idea of journalism. We need to dive a little bit into some history here, but I think most people's ideal of journalism that is freely available to all and is high quality has got to be Walter Cronkite on TV. I think it's the canonical example, and you will not find somebody who disagrees with that statement.
I'm sorry to interrupt. For listeners that may be younger and don't remember, Walter Cronkite was the lead anchor at CBS for years and years through the Vietnam War. I remember growing up with Walter Cronkite, Uncle Walt, as sometimes he was called. And just as a quick aside, he was a big fan of Carl Jensen and Project Censored. But I digress. John, back to you.
He was just terrific. Everybody's ideal. There's no exception, I think. So TV, the technology of TV, enforces that everybody gets it for free. There's no other way that TV can work. That's the way that what we call terrestrial broadcast technology needs to work. That's just it. That technological requirement puts in place the idea that somehow it's got to be funded by advertising, and that put in place somehow the idea that government, Congress, needed to make sure that it was high quality. So there was this thing called the Fairness Doctrine. And the Fairness Doctrine served us very well for a long time.
Until 1987, when it was repealed.
Exactly. So now that the TV is not required to be fair and balanced, they start being less fair and balanced. And they do that because just the whole advertising thing just becomes such a monster, such an insatiable monster. And the needs there and the way the businesses need to do certain things in order to make enough money, it's just led us down this path that we're headed down. So you asked me, is there a model? I think if I sum up your question, I could say, is there a model by which a free quality news can be made available? That's hard. And what I think you can't have is free quality news paid for by advertising. I think you can't have that. I think you can have quality news paid for by subscriptions. And then there's this gray area in between that I don't think we've figured out the answer to that yet.
It sounds like, too, we could argue that media bias becomes a business model. That's what we saw with the ending of the Fairness Doctrine. We saw AM radio go that way and fill the vacuum on the right wing of the spectrum. Then in the mid-90s with Roger Ailes from the Reagan administration, we saw the rise of Fox News, and there was a guaranteed audience if they went one direction. And then we saw later MSNBC kind of go the other direction and get those so-called news customers. So bias becomes the model in many cases, where your brand is about your partisanship and your bias, and somewhere the truth is, well, we don't know. In between, outside, gets harder to find. And of course, if you couple that with the lack of critical thinking, pedagogy, and what's been happening in schools and with higher education, we kind of have this recipe that social media, it's the perfect storm, if you will. The advent, the rise of social media, a mass resurgence of partisan opinion, so-called journalism. And then, of course, these major tech giants, I mean, they're preying upon all of the people that are using these so-called free platforms. And so one of the questions with the tech giants, and of course now this is front and center with Twitter and Facebook banning Trump and so forth, raising key issues of what it means to have censorship in the marketplace and what can the government do and what are private companies allowed to do. The big question for you, John Marshall, are they helping or hurting democratic culture, the tech giants?
Are they helping or hurting? Well, of course, it's possible that they're doing both. I've been doing a lot of thinking about the role that fabricated news is playing in getting people riled up. One of the problems that I think we have, particularly in the US, is a particularly acute problem in the US, that First Amendment rights are very sacred. And there's no implied criticism of that, actually. I think that that First Amendment serves us well. There's a possible way out of the mess that we've got ourselves into. And over the past week, I've just been noodling on this. The idea of First Amendment right and free speech does have limitations. There are places where, as a society, we do not say that you can just say whatever you want. Now, the obvious example is you can't incite violence. It's clear the Supreme Court upholds that. You cannot incite violence. That is not protected speech. But I think also we would say that bias in news is protected speech. Bias is not that straightforward. And I think we have to accept that, yes, in fact, I even believe that there's no such thing as unbiased news. I think all news has bias. So what I wonder is if advertising, which is funding disinformation, we definitely have news out there, which is disinformation. I think sometimes we can't identify it as disinformation in the moment. And as things have become very rapid online, that becomes a problem. But I think we can say after the fact, sometimes 30 seconds later, sometimes 2 weeks later, we can say, well, that news item was disinformation. That is actually not correct. Now, right now, that disinformation exists out there and it continues to make money. I'm wondering if the advertising that funds that disinformation can be choked off. And I'm wondering if advertising, since you can't eliminate fake news, maybe what you can do is eliminate advertising that funds fake news. Actually, Mickey, you have more experience. What do you think? Do you think it can be done?
I think that we need to do something. You write about that as a possible solution, regulating ad tech. We talked earlier, and you said you had actually asked attorneys, media bias experts, fraud investigators, you're asking them, do you think that this is something that we could do? You've even suggested, I think at one point, is there a way that ad companies could be fined for peddling false information? Was that something that you put forward?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of remedies. And I think that you can use the example of existing legislation. So for example, a manufacturer of processed foods is required to put a nutritional label on the box. And I can make the statement, they can't lie. They can lie, but if they get caught, the penalties are pretty severe. So we already have a mechanism of the system whereby we prohibit false advertising. We already do this. What I'm wondering is, can we build on that same thing? You cannot straight up lie in advertising. So what I'm really proposing is that when you look at a web page and you've got the news item that you want to read and you've got the ads that surround it, right now, those ads are regulated. They cannot contain lies. The words on the page are not. They can be complete lies. I'm wondering if we can spread the legislation into the words via the ad tech companies. I don't know yet. I'm still exploring the question. In fact, I'd love to hear from people. Tell me, what do you think about this idea? Is this viable?
We have a couple minutes left. We're going to have to wrap up. And I want to be sure that you give people your contact information, where they can find your book. We want people to be able to read your arguments and the research that you've done. Last question, though, to end on, people concerned about privacy. That's the underside of the free is bad, is that we're not customers of social media. We're products. They're harvesting our information. We're giving it to them, and they're selling it, and then they're using it to target us with even more messaging. So what are your thoughts on that, John Marshall?
There are ways that it harms us, and we need to be clear and divide them up into different categories of stuff. Facebook harvests, of course, the most information. I would say that they have the biggest heap of information, and there is some harm that can be derived from that. I think that that harm is possibly less than the harm that could be derived from your email messages. I'm particularly concerned about email because of the way that we treat it as just this disposable thing. I don't use Gmail. One of the reasons I don't is that I don't want Google to know how much money I make. And that usually causes people to stop for a moment. Wait a minute, how does Google know how much money? Well, I'll tell you, it's very straightforward. If you file taxes, particularly so in California, you pay your quarterly taxes, which is what I have to do, and you get a nice receipt. And there's the amount. It's right there in plain text in the email. I am not going to hand that data to Google.
John Marshall, we're going to have to wrap up this segment. I want to let you have the last word, what you're hoping to accomplish with this book, Free is Bad. And please give people a contact and places where they can find it.
The book is on Amazon, a few other places as well. The TLDR edition, the abbreviated one, is actually free. It's a rare instance of free is good. all of my contact information is at the website for the book, freeisbad.com. If you reach out to me on Twitter, I have stickers that I will send to you in the mail just as a thank you. Here's the reason to read the book. When you pick up your smartphone and you start fiddling around and you look at your email and you look at social media and you look at the news and you think to yourself, is this good for me? Am I giving up more than I'm getting in return? Should I be concerned? My book will guide you through whether you should be concerned. Is this something to be concerned about? Because for some people, it doesn't matter, and I fully respect that. We all have our own choices to make. If you are concerned about, for example, email, I will walk you through the steps to fix that. Each of the chapters takes a different aspect of the stuff that shows up on your phone. And that's it.
The website one more time, John Marshall.
Freeisbad.com.
Author of Free is Bad, How the Free Web Hurt Privacy, Truth, and Democracy, and What You Can Do About It. John Marshall, thanks so much for your good work, and thank you for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you, Mickey.
Up next on the Project Censored Show, we welcome back Nolan Higdon. We'll be discussing a post-coup de Trump autopsy of American democracy and facing the reality of what neoliberalism has wrought. We'll discuss the events at the Capitol, the role of media and social media, and current cries for censorship online. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are joined once again by Dr. Nolan Higdon, author and university lecturer of history and media studies. His areas of concentration include youth culture, news media history, and critical media literacy. He sits on the boards of the Action Coalition for Media Education, or ACME, and Northwest Alliance for Alternative Media and Education. His most recent publications include United States of Distraction, co-authored with me. Also, more recently, The Anatomy of Fake News, a critical news literacy education from University of California Press. That was out last summer. Nolan is also co-host of the Along the Line podcast with Dr. Dreadlocks, Nick Baham III. Nolan Higdon, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's very timely as we see a lot of discussion around the events at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. from January 6th. And of course, with increased tension and suspicion that there will be more actions, perhaps like it. We also know that there has been, leading up to this, as argued in United States of Distraction, our media circus and hyperpartisan environment, the role social media plays in radicalizing people. Recently, you and I wrote an article, A Post-Coup de Trump Autopsy of American Democracy, Facing the Reality of What Neoliberalism Has Wrought. That's up on counterpunch.org. Nolan, what do you mean when we're talking about the events of the last week or two and the role of neoliberalism in all of this?
It's a big question, and I encourage the audience to kind of remember that you have to hold multiple ideas in your head at once. And we talk about the events on January 6th. I think it's critical to remember that there is a lot that we do know. There was press on the ground. There was video. There are some accounts of what happened. Obviously, we know violence occurred. We know people died. We know there were threats made. We know people had bombs. Those are things that are pretty well documented, at least in my assessment. But there's also a lot of stuff we really don't know. We don't know which portion of the people there had a goal of going in and committing violence. Some people, it does appear from the video, were led in by the Capitol Police. Also, when it comes to the people who are there, we really don't know what everybody's goal was or how well organized they really were or what role social media, if any, played in organizing this event or these people's perceptions. And again, I'm not discounting that any of that stuff is possible. We just don't know. And I think one thing the last 4 or 5 years should have taught us, we need to get comfortable sitting back and analyzing evidence as it comes in and not jump to knee-jerk reactions or conclusions. But in our article, we talk about how it's still crucial to remember the role that, that neoliberalism played. I mean, me and you, Mickey, we wrote this book, United States of Distraction, to say that if you don't treat Trump like the symptom that he is, our democracy is really threatened. There's a 40-year series of events that got us to the point where Trump seemed like a viable candidate to enough of the electorate to take over the presidency. And I was really hoping in the 4 years he was president that that would change, but sad to report it has not. Just a couple months ago, remember all this conversation about how democracy was on the ballot. I mean, it really is an unsophisticated way of looking at electoral politics that you can somehow vote away or censor away anti-democratic impulses in your society. People who do not believe in the system and do not believe in institutions and do not believe in the Democratic Party, which, by the way, hit its lowest approval rating in 2014 when Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama led it, those people don't come out of the ground being that way. They're shaped by what they see. Yes, part of it is information and misinformation, but also as a part of it is the failure of neoliberalism. At least some of these people who voted for Donald Trump were desperate people. And they put their faith in someone. I don't think they really understood this, you know, disaster that was Donald Trump. To give you kind of an anecdotal experience, on Election Day 2020, I was walking through Trump country in Oregon, and I looked down in the gutter a couple of days after the election, and there was a crumpled up bumper sticker, and it said, Trump 2020, make liberals cry again. And I thought it really summed up the Trump voter. They're not really voting for like a policy or something. They're just so angry at these neoliberals who are in leadership and establishment. I think that really helps you kind of understand where this electorate's at. And so by prodding them or making fun of them or labeling them, I don't think that's going to get them to start voting more in line with democratic values. But I do think if the leaders of this country and the policymakers actually give folks something to vote for, then you would see a lot more support for the institutions and politicians and a lot less support for Trump. But unfortunately, the only opposition party to the Republicans is the Democrats, and they haven't been there for 40 years and don't seem to be going there.
Indeed. The article mentioned the Democracy Index. The U.S. is considered a flawed democracy by these studies. Scholars have noted in the last decade that the U.S. is, in fact, an oligarchy. It really isn't a democratic republic. So more of these slogans about democracy being under attack and democracy is on the ballot, that's also part of propaganda that we see in the major corporate press, certainly around the framing of these events. And we see now that there may be up to 15 Capitol Police under investigation or suspension for their alleged role in letting people into the Capitol or colluding or just simply not doing anything to remove people who are illegally there in a menacing fashion. It's hard for us to wait in the instant gratification world of social media, where a majority of people actually go to get news and information. So could you talk to us about some of the main points in the article about focusing our energies on education? We didn't just get here overnight. Why are people so vulnerable to fake news? You write about this in your book, The Anatomy of Fake News.
We have 100 million people who do not vote, and they are disproportionately non-educated women and people of color. I'm not ragging on these folks. The polls are very interesting. It says quite clearly the reason they don't vote is because they feel neither party represents them. That alone should be a reason to quote-unquote put democracy on the ballot, that we have 100 million people who will not turn out to vote. And again, like you pointed out, that has to do a lot with these neoliberal policies. These neoliberal policies have not been focused on improving the material conditions of the citizens of the United States. They've been focused on this idea of growing the macro economy, which disproportionately affects the top 1%. And everybody else is increasingly losing more and more ground as these decades persist. The whole irony of the Trump situation is because Democrats had abandoned class politics, as Boots Riley recently noted, Trump was able to hijack the rhetoric of like a populist class figure, right? He talked about repealing NAFTA, and he was going to bring the jobs back, and he was going to improve wages. There was no way it was ever going to happen. But because the Democrats were just so afraid of that rhetoric, Trump could hijack it for his own purposes. That in itself is like an illustration of why the Democrats need to get back to material conditions. They've really gotten comfortable in this place where they sell neoliberalism with the veneer of diversity. So these neoliberal policies and structures, which are responsible for the perpetuation of sexism and racism and inequality in our society, are sold to us with people who have faces of diversity, like women and people of color. The irony of this is when you talk to folks about solving inequity, they recognize that things are based in like material conditions. And so you have this idea that there needs to be, for example, material goods to equal out racial conditions, whether it be wages or access to homes and things like this, right? But then when you talk about how we need to address material inequities with actual policies that deal with income inequality or housing, then somehow you're like a Marxist and a socialist and you're crazy. So they recognized how changing material conditions is the solution, but they refuse to recognize how the current way that materials are allocated are part of the problem. And the way materials are allocated have been under that sort of neoliberal framework since the 1980s.
People are more and more susceptible to disinformation, misinformation. We've linked the privatization of the public school system, the dumbing down of curriculum, a lack of critical pedagogy, along with mass conglomeration, the five corporations controlling about 90% of the news media. When you start connecting all of these dots and you start looking at the rise of social media and the clickbait phenomenon that exacerbates confirmation bias, people can go and look for what they want to find. And our institutions have really suffered a major blow. And I know one of the points that you make in many of your articles and writings is that we really need to restore faith in public institutions, in journalism, a free press, in education. And there are concrete ways to do those things. There are ways that we can address those challenges. Could you speak to that point, Nolan Higdon?
I write about this a lot, that even after the election of Trump, there was a lot of people, politicians and those in media, who said, you know, we need to reach out and understand the Trump voter. We need to change things. But really, over 4 years, educated political and media elite just kept talking down to people. They didn't talk with them. So one of the things I think we need to recognize is that whether you hate or love Republicans or conservatives, they're not going away. We're going to have to learn how to live together in this nation of 330 million people. As part of an education, that's a sign of a good thing. Polls are pretty clear that exposure to more diverse viewpoints leads to people actually changing their voting patterns and adopting more policy positions than party dogma. So this is a good thing. And one of the ways we can do that is by creating an education system that really emphasizes that the purpose of our education system is not for job creation. It's for strengthening our democracy. It's teaching people the skills to participate in our democracy, how our democracy works, understanding where different viewpoints come from, and learning how to argue and agree where we can and disagree where we have to. But you don't need to hate someone as like your ideological enemy. That's where this bleeds into media and politics, which is our media system is too one-sided. If you want to hear anything critical of Democrats, you have to turn on Fox. And if you want to hear anything critical of Republicans, you have to turn on MSNBC. That's not the way it should be. You should have a journalistic class that wants to hold all leaders accountable, that seeks to follow the evidence where it may lead. And so one of the things you can do as a citizen that I always recommend is just cut the 24-hour news crap from your diet. And also don't conflate social media with news. Social media companies or advertising companies, they're not news media companies. You need to track down legitimate journalists who time and time again are right, who time and time again follow the evidence even when it's unpopular. You know, those folks like Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald and Abby Martin and Manar Mahawish, Ryan Grimm, Sanger and Getty for your conservative folks out there. These folks do good work all the time where the evidence may lead. Those are the type of people to follow. What Rachel Maddow or Sean Hannity think is completely irrelevant. They're not journalists. They don't study anything. You're probably dumber for having listened to it.
So I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking with Dr. Nolan Higdon. He is the author of United States of Distraction. Also, more recently, The Anatomy of Fake News, a critical news literacy education. We're speaking about a recent article that's at Counterpunch, a post-coup to Trump autopsy of American democracy and facing the reality of what neoliberalism has wrought. We'll continue that conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the show, we're continuing our conversation about the role of media and neoliberalism in the current events that have been taking place in the nation's capital. Again, our guest, Dr. Nolan Higdon, author and university lecturer in history and media studies. His recent publications include United States of Distraction with City Lights 2019. We co-authored that. More recently, in summer of 2020, he published The Anatomy of Fake News, a critical news literacy education that's out on the University of California Press. Nolan Higdon, before the break, you were talking to us about the role, the significant role of having a civic-centered pedagogy and critical media literacy and the way that we can be teaching our youth and others about how to navigate the minefield of our political culture. In this recent article, you go back and revisit the thesis of United States of Distraction, where it wasn't all Trump all the time. We saw Trump more as a key symptom, not the cause of declining democratic culture in the U.S. Could you talk about that?
Trump cannot be held completely responsible for the decline of American democracy. If Trump had come into office and started using the fake news epithet and it worked, that would have been amazing. But the reality is that the only reason it worked is because the media was already in a weakened or emaciated state. Go back to like the 1970s. Remember, Nixon tried to weaponize liberal media, and it was almost laughed at because there was so much faith in journalism at the time. But Trump was able to walk in with fake news because the opinion of the journalistic class was so low after ginormous failures like 2003 invasion of Iraq comes to mind, or the polling around the 2016 election, or the promises of NAFTA. These things by elites in the media, it turned out to be false. And so people lost faith in that. And Trump and his infinite wisdom, man, this is his skill, is he can always point out the things that these elites don't want pointed out. He was able to do that about the Democrats. He was able to do that about the media. And I understand why some of his supporters are so frustrated with the media and Democrats, and it feels good to hear Trump say these things, but we must understand it's not productive. You're not moving the society in a direction where it's adopting policies, planning, or infrastructure to benefit the people. You're just owning the libs, which might feel good for, you know, a second, but it's not going to really change the material conditions in which you live.
We've long talked about these issues, neoliberal policies that have been embraced by both parties, particularly the corporate centrist and conservative Democrats, where more traditional liberal principles based on free speech or expression, open elections, etc. There have been a lot of ways that Democrats have really disappointed many liberals and neoliberals in particular and centrist and Democratic Party. They may support a free and open internet or free speech unless it involves criticizing Israel and Palestine. Academic freedom is great unless you're Mark Crispin Miller at NYU. Whistleblowers, WikiLeaks, and Julian Assange was great with Chelsea Manning, but now is a friend of Putin and an enemy of the state. We could go on and on here, including the Harris-Biden ticket. Talk to us a little bit about some of the neoliberal embrace of the Democrats and its contribution to the frustration that many people are experiencing today.
Much like the Republicans did in the early 21st century and continue to do, the Democrats have now adopted the sensibility where anything they do is fine as long as it serves to defeat Republicans. That sort of sensibility is really dangerous when it comes to issues like freedom of speech, academic freedom, other forms of civil liberties, censorship. This is really a dangerous kind of place we've entered. And what's more dangerous is I expect some of this from politicians who will be hyperbolic and demagoguery to get elected. What I'm more surprised is by the amount of voters I see this in. I, like you, work in academia where it's tough to find a conservative. They're like a freaking endangered species. But I'm also stunned how many of the so-called liberals or neoliberals in higher education have just totally adopted this stuff. Censorship is justified and academic freedom. We need to shut these people up. And it's like, isn't this supposed to be a place where we share ideas and talk openly? And this is quite scary where a lot of these places are going. They're going to where I saw the conservatives go in the early 21st century.
We see more and more liberals and Democrats now supporting censorship, the banning of Donald Trump from Twitter and Facebook and other places. You and I and others at Project Censored, Mint Press News, other places, been following the rise of social media censorship, YouTube deplatforming. And it's curious because the Alex Jones case was an early trial balloon that many liberals applauded. And within a month, 800 organizations had been deplatformed on Twitter. That was a couple years ago. That's continued en masse. And of course, this past week and a half, I'm not defending the statements of Donald Trump. I'm not saying they aren't incendiary, but weren't they all along?
The fact that you have to give that qualifier right there, that the idea that you're right. standing up against censorship, you have to make a qualifier that, but I'm not standing up for Trump, that already illustrates that there's like a chilling effect in the culture that you have to make that qualifier. You can stand up for free speech without defending the content of what is said. The other thing I'll say is that when I was in school and I read about like the House Un-American Activities Committee and McCarthyites and the Hollywood blacklist, I didn't find it to be an inspirational tale, but apparently there's this new sensibility in the United States in general, but particularly amongst the Democratic Party, where they've been red baiting over Russia for the last 4 years. And now that these fears about Russia and fears about insurrection are being used for censorship, they're using this really naive or unsophisticated argument that these social media companies are private and they can do what they want. That's misleading on a number of levels. Number one, social media companies basically just bought the public sphere. More people use social media to communicate than any other form of communication. It's larger than any communal square that's ever existed in human history. So that makes it different. But number two, and I think more importantly, this is censorship by proxy. These companies, thanks to Snowden and other classified documents we know, have contracts with the federal government. They also take loans from the federal government, and they're also using properties that were invented by the federal government, i.e. the internet. So this idea that they're somehow independent is false. And there's a historical analogy here. I mentioned the Hollywood blacklist. Hollywood censored people, but they did it through collusion with the federal government. Some of the people who were part of this collusion were like Ronald Reagan, who was head of the Screen Actors Guild, but also an FBI informant. So that excuse that they're private companies operates within a historical vacuum. And then the last thing I'd like to kind of point out, too, is that it's not just right-wing voices. I know plenty of right-wingers who've been censored, and you know, it's great at some level I don't have to hear them, but I recognize once you open up right-wing voices, lefties get censored. I'll give you an example. I was part of, like you and others, who hosted the Critical Media Literacy Conference, The Americas, which was predicated on having discussions about how to get classroom content through media to defeat things like racist sensibilities and sexist sensibilities and break down white supremacy in the classroom. All of the videos for our conference were removed from YouTube as part of this mass censorship move by YouTube, and they didn't explain why. So apparently academics are now being censored. And you know, that conference, I'll tell you, is like as left as it gets in the United States. So it's an illustration that a lot of people are operating under a false assumption that this is targeting like right-wing fascists. It's much more expansive, and it's not just private companies.
Chris Hedges was just talking on Democracy Now! Not long ago about that very issue, that those that are cheering the deplatforming of those like a Donald Trump, where is this going to go next? Hedges said, in the end, the left pays for this kind of censorship. People now calling for more police and more authority. Well, where is the police and the authority most often historically used? It's often used against people's movements, civil rights movements. It's rare in this country that you see that kind of power effected against conservative or right-wing type protest movements. Nolan Higdon?
During the Cold War, they were infiltrating the anti-war movement, trying to radicalize these people as a pretext to put them in jail. They infiltrated the civil rights movement, going as far as trying to get Dr. King to commit suicide. During the War on Terror, they were infiltrating anti-war groups, and you saw what they did with Occupy. So when you give these expansive policing powers for a supposed threat, it almost always is used against progressives and almost always used against the most vulnerable in society, particularly people of color. So again, it's just really naive to sit there on the sidelines and cheerleader.
Another fascinating metric, Twitter's stock dumped by 10%, recovering back to about 7 over the weekend, last week, I'm sorry. In our country, we always look at money. That's part of the neoliberal sensibility. It's not we the people making these decisions. It's the upper echelons. It's the investment class. So, you know, in many cases, we've argued, Nolan Higdon, that Donald Trump helped peel back the gilded veneer of democracy. And his presidency, in many cases, again, is the symptom. Of course, you've argued, too, that this has made the U.S. ripe for more fascistic political culture. So we've got a couple of minutes left here, and I was wondering if you could tie some pieces together there and close out our conversation with that idea.
Neoliberalism emerged out of the mid-20th century with an idea that we need to give more power to elites, and we need to create like independent institutions and give them more power. Obviously, like the Federal Reserve already existed, but it was further empowered in the neoliberal age. You create private companies, and you hand over what used to be done by government to them. And basically, you take the power out of the hands of the people, because the people are seen as like too dumb or too emotional to handle these things, right? That's how neoliberals see the public. And look, this was on full display during this pandemic. Neoliberals sold this bag of goods in 2008 through 10 about we need universal health care tied to employment. Because God forbid people who don't have a job get health care. Well, then you had a pandemic that knocked these people out of work and they don't have health care. And then they bailed out industry four friggin' times. And all they could give was a measly $1,200 check and then a $600 check later. And it's not that like this is some radical fringe element. Like polls show universal health care, background checks, stimulus checks. These things were all like overwhelmingly supported by large majorities of the public. But the neoliberal class thinks the public is too dumb and emotional. So they just go about business as usual. And as long as that persists, you're going to have this anger. And I think some of the people are going to react with their anger in the way that we saw at the Capitol, which in itself is also not productive. But something's got to give. And I would argue we're in a much better place if we shift away from neoliberalism than if we follow the route of storming the Capitol.
Nolan, thanks so much again for coming on the program.
Thanks, Mickey.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear this.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program, also the host, Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. Fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.